This week on A to Z Running, we share both the results of and the experiences participating in the U.S. Olympic Trials Marathon.
We also answer a listener question about shoe drops and knee pain.
In the world of running, the trials were filled with upsets, heartbreak, and unexpected moments. We've got a lot to say about that.
And indoor track action has been a thrill, including national records and near misses.
All this and more on A to Z Running.
Welcome back to the A to Z Running Podcast, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching and training services. I'm Andy.
And I am Zach. And if you want to learn more about any of the things that we do or all the stuff that we talk about, you can find it all at atozrunning.com, or you can follow us on the places where people follow people, like Instagram, YouTube, and Spotify.
Well, I want to give a shout out because we met a lot of people at the Olympic Trials Marathon. So thank you for those of you who introduced yourselves and connected with us. We love it. We love the running community. If you started listening to this podcast because we met recently, welcome. We're so glad that you're here and we're excited to continue to grow this awesome community that we have. Zach's nodding like, yes. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Andy definitely did talk to a lot of people at the Olympic Trials, and I spent a lot of time trying not to talk to people, which is much more interesting.
He's not a grouch. He just was trying to conserve some energy after we went to Legoland and had like the masses and all the people, and he needed to like chill out before the marathon.
Well, that sounds nice, but it's just not true at all. I'm just not a very social person, and so we were talking with a number of people about like, oh, isn't it so cool to like, you know, be there and like interact with all these people, and I'm thinking to myself, well, it is, but I can't say that I do it very well. As a matter of fact, I do it quite poorly. And I get done with, an experience where we're mingling and doing all these things. And I think to myself, I'm not sure I actually interacted with anybody there. And I'm not so sure that I would have done anything any differently if I was thinking about it. So if you were one of those people who I didn't interact with and you thought it strange that I wasn't, my apologies. That's pretty normal for Zach.
Well, I enjoyed it immensely, and thank you so much if you're joining us for the first time. Now let's get on to your questions.
Remember to ask your questions by going directly to the email address. Well, you don't go to email addresses. Send your questions to the email address questions@atozrunning.com. That's questions@atozrunning.com. And then we'll share them on air, and we'll also respond to your email and share thoughts there, especially if we don't always have a chance to feature every single question that someone sends to us, but we still give you some thoughts in response, even if it doesn't make it onto the show. But chances are it's going to make it on the show too.
Yeah.
So Do it.
So Lorenda sent us a question. I've been trying to ease back into running after 6 weeks off from a knee injury. I've been attempting some short treadmill jogs to just see how it feels. After 3 to 5 minutes, I generally start feeling my knee ache mildly, so I throw in the towel. I'm trying to be extra cautious so I don't have any setbacks. Yesterday, I noticed that if I transition more to the 4-mid strike after feeling an ache, it's more comfortable on my knee and I can make it further. With that said, I've been thinking about a 0-drop shoe. I'm currently at a 7-millimeter heel-to-toe drop. Would you say that's too extreme of a change? Curious your thoughts on transitioning to a different drop or thoughts on 0-drop altogether for distance running.
Okay, well, there's a few layers here involved. Thank you for the question, Lorenda. The first thing is, if you're on a treadmill, it's not always going to be the same solution than if you're on like open roads. And so meaning like if you change some foot mechanics on the treadmill, chances are that more closely replicates like what you might be doing naturally on a road, because treadmills just change how we run in general. So there's a thought there, seeing how it feels one versus the other before trying to identify whether something is solving the problem would be important, I think. Treadmills and knee pain seem to have a bad relationship. But that said, your question, though, more specifically, I think is an important one. Should we change the nature of structurally of our shoes? and why and when should we make that change? And in your particular situation here, you've got a knee injury that you're recovering from, and you're trying to sort out if that's a good time to change the shoe, as well if that would help with the potential knee pain that you're currently feeling, or help prevent the injury reoccurring.
We should have asked Dr. Bill Johncock about this.
Sure. Do you have him on call? You just send him
sometimes
questions?
Hey, Dr. Johncock, hey, if you are listening to the show and you have a thought on this, feel free to send it our way.
All right. And it may just contradict what I'm about to say, but I'm going to say my thoughts anyway.
Okay.
First, I don't like zero drop shoes. And there's a very simple reason. Because we don't operate as a society in that kind of footwear normally, most of us. And so it's highly unnatural to go from the other kind of footwear that we wear for everything else to a zero drop shoe, and then we slam the ground over and over for an hour or more. That's not generally safe to do. And so almost everyone who goes to a zero drop shoe has injury troubles. And I do mean that literally. Almost everyone has injury troubles when they go to zero drop. So that begs two questions. First, one is, why would you want to make that change? Because if that why is not strong enough, I wouldn't even bother with it. There's no point. But secondly, if the why is strong enough, then how do you do it in order to not be one of those majority who are struggling with injuries? And so that's where we kind of have to consider your situation specifically here, Lorenda. You've got a knee problem. You want to make sure that something like that is not going to exacerbate that. Of course, your thought here is that it would help with that. It's hard to test that very easily without high risk. So there's a couple of things there. First, you could seek some expert advice, like a podiatrist like Bill Johncock, but seek some expert advice, someone who can do an evaluation for you, like the shoe I'm wearing right now, and what does it look like when I'm running in it, and what is this doing in terms of mechanics and such. The second thing is, almost all of our kinds of joint related things, like knee, ankle, hip types of problems, can be improved by mechanical strength and mobility work. So how am I moving, and how strong or weak or flexible am I, and how can I improve those things? And so in improving those things, we almost always resolve whatever those issues are. There are certainly issues that require other kinds of interventions, but many of them resolved simply by improving that stuff. So that's the first place we go before we make any kind of wholesale changes of things, because those are the kinds of solutions that address the heart of the issue more immediately. Now, if the heart of the issue is structural, and a shoe change would help with that, then the question becomes, if you're going to do that, how to do it in a way that is safe and effective. And so that, first of all, gradual is better than anything. 7 millimeter to zero is not a huge jump, but it's substantial. And so can you find a shoe that's somewhere in between? And we're going to start there. But then also, you're not just switching shoes gradually. You need to work on ankle mobility, flexibility. You need to work on foot strength and ankle strength. And you need to address how you're hitting the ground. Because if you're hitting the ground the same way in a zero drop shoe that you did in a 7 millimeter shoe, it's going to cause problems, because it's not the same. It's not doing the same thing in terms of your actual structural impact on the ground, because of the difference in then your heel. So you need to work through a lot of those things, and you need to do so incrementally. So we start with strength and mobility always, because that's the kind of thing that there's no risk in better strength and mobility. So start there. And then after some time, and I would say at a minimum 2 to 4 weeks of doing something before you're really going to even notice benefits. So at a minimum, wait 4 weeks before you change any shoe stuff once you're doing strength and mobility work for your foot and ankle. There's a great video from Phil Wharton back in the day where one of those minimalist shoe companies wanted to help people who are trying to go to a minimalist shoe not get hurt. Great thing to do. If you're a minimalist shoe company and you have a bad rap for injuring people, you should see what you can do to help them. So they hired Phil Wharton to do a video demonstrating how to work through the strengthening process so that we can handle that kind of a change. And so that's you know, that's the kind of thinking. There's a lot involved in that. And it includes strengthening your feet, strengthening your ankles, and not just strengthening your feet in general, but strengthening the different kinds of movements, your big toe as your stability, your rotationary forces, as well as everything in the kinetic chain from there. So that's what we would say, Lorenda. There's a lot to be said there. And what it amounts to is this is the kind of thing that you change the first likeliest thing before the last likeliest thing. And the first likeliest thing here is general strength, mobility, and mechanical stuff with your current running factors. And if you address those things first, you may see that the problems resolve at that point and you don't need to make any other changes. So we start there.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Lorenda, for your question. Now we're going to talk about the Olympic trials. So what we're going to do in this episode is we're first going to discuss our experience at the Olympic trials, specifically Zach's experience as a participant in the Orlando trials. And then after that, we're going to do the World of Running segment and we're going to talk about the results of the Olympic trials. So starting with our experience, it was really fun to be able to go and support Zach in Orlando. Our family came. We had tons of support. So thank you to our family and friends. And we had athletes, Laura and Steph, who came down to watch too. That was really special. It was a cool experience of the running community coming together and specifically our support system being there to cheer on Zach. So Zach, I have some questions for you because many people have been asking me and we haven't even had a chance to really discuss all the things that I would love to know. And other people have asked me about your race. So I think first, just tell people what it's like. What is the process of the Olympic trials? Like, do your bottle checks, your credentials? What is it like when you first got to Orlando?
So first, I also need to at least just acknowledge the people who are down and supporting because that was really cool stuff. And that's the kind of thing that, like, you know, running on the for the most part is a thing we do because we enjoy the thing. Most runners don't run for too many other reasons. There's a short list of reasons that we do it. And so I would do something like that by myself in the woods, you know, for hours and enjoy it. But the experience has a greater kind of existential worth in a situation like this where, you know, we've got family and friends watching, traveling to come to the event and such. And so that's humbling. You know, that certainly is like, you know, these people care for more reasons than just, you know, because it's enjoyable. Because I don't think that too many of us would travel to a random race in a different place to watch it, except for knowing people involved or, you know, certainly
being a fan of the sport.
Being a fan of the sport, yeah.
Trials,
but yeah. Not very many of us would travel to a race just because we're a fan of the sport unless there's other people involved in that, right? Friends are doing it with us or we're going to see people we know. So in any event, I'm saying this because a lot of people came, a lot of our family, and Andy mentioned some friends. And then I have to give a mad shout out to our physical therapist, Adam Homolka at Endurance Rehab, Endurance Rehabilitation and Athletics. That's in West Michigan. And if you need a physical therapist who understands running, he's the guy. And we've said this many times because he is, in fact, the guy. And his outfit is the place you got to go. But Adam travels for these big events. Why? You know, to help out the athletes that he supports and works with. So he comes down there and he works with me to keep me healthy before and after the event and others as well. And so thanks to all and much appreciated. So now back to the question then. Okay, so the Olympic trials event experience is not particularly unique of its own accord. It's very similar to a number of race events where there's certain accommodations for athletes. And so if you were to go to something like the Chicago Marathon as an elite athlete, it'd be a very familiar experience to the Olympic trials. The difference being, and this is what's so profound about this particular event, is other races, like mentioned, you know, even the marathon majors or something, they have a small number of athletes who they invite as the elite athletes or the pro athletes in the field, because it's expensive, and also because there's more of those races going on. And so it might be 50 athletes, it might be 70, it kind of depends on the event. But at the Olympic trials, it's like 400 athletes who are all receiving the quote elite athlete treatment. So that is quite an undertaking. It's a very different kind of dynamic in scale, similar in kind, different in scale. So here's what's involved in that. You've got things like you have to check in for the race days in advance. You can wait until the day before. They don't love it if you check in that late, but you can. But at least a day or two before, you got to check in, which means you go find the people. They're at a particular hotel in some kind of like conference room. You go find them and you say, I'm this person. And they check your identity and confirm. And then they tell you all the stuff you need to know. And it's like, you know, you have to go to this room to get this thing. You have to take your stuff over there to have them look at it. You need to pick up this stuff and drop off this stuff. And it all has to be done at these windows of times. And, oh, by the way, there's this mandatory meeting you got to be at. Of course, I've always wondered, they always say that, but they don't do anything to double check who is at that mandatory meeting. So I'm not quite sure that mandatory is the right word there. But anyway, so those things include the following. The check-in is like, here's your stuff. And the check-in includes giving you your race bib, which is familiar. Anyone who goes to an event, you have to check in at some point to get your race credentials, your bib with your timing, all that kind of stuff. They also give you a specific credential that you have to wear at different points in time. And if you don't have it, the race bib itself is not necessarily enough to get you into the different places. And they have like all these zones marked out, which I've never actually paid attention to that. So I imagine there would be places that I would try to walk into and they'd say, no, you don't have the right zone approval for that, because the credential says which zones you can enter. But what it amounts to is they give you that information, and that includes then essentially your like checklist of other things you have to do, when you have to do it and where you have to do it. And that checklist included then a uniform check. So at the U.S. Olympic trials, you now have to abide by the USA track and field uniform guidelines. That also includes World Athletics uniform guidelines, but those are much more broad and open than USA. So those guidelines include you can only have one logo on any given apparel item. So like if you have these Nike shorts that have cool Nike logos in multiple places, that's not okay. It's not allowed.
Not even
so,
two.
Not even two. One and only one. And so, you know, depending on what you bring your stuff, you have to actually bring. So here's what they say. You have to bring not just the thing you're going to race in, but anything you're going to wear in the athlete zone, which is like the area you're getting ready for the race or the area you are right after the race. So that athlete zone, anything you wear, warm-ups, hats, socks, anything. So you get it all out, and hopefully you brought it with you, because if you didn't, you got to come back later. So you get it all out, and then the guy lays it all out on the table, and it takes forever because he's got to look at through each thing, and then he has to lay it all out and take a picture of it, because this is the like official proof. If you wear anything that's not in that picture, you are subject to the potential problems, what consequences, including possibly disqualification. So yes. So then they lay it all out. Now, if you've got an item that has logos that are unapproved, no problem. They're just going to give you a roll of tape, like duct tape, and you got to tape the thing so it's covered. So naturally, I already knew coming into it that I had unapproved logos on my apparel because, well, let's face it, we here at A to Z Running really want people to see A to Z Running on the stuff we wear. So we put it all over the place. Well, you can't have more than one logo on a garment, so got to decide which ones to cover up and then throw some tape over it.
But we should mention that A to Z Running is now an official USATF recognized team.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Which, if it wasn't, you wouldn't even be able to have the logos at all.
Right.
For the most part, club organizations are taped over at these events. You see tape all over people's uniforms, and that's why. Well, so A to Z Running, we've got the logos showing, but you can only have one on each item. So like the hat that I want to wear has two logos on it. So I got to put tape on my hat, on my sock. No, not my socks. On my
uniform,
on my warm up jacket, all that stuff. Right. So anyway, making this short thing long, the point is we go over to the table and I got to tape up a bunch of stuff and then lay it all out. And then the guy's having a really hard time figuring out how to lay it because you have to be able to see all of the logos when he lays it out, the ones you taped and the ones that aren't taped. So he's like having to fold things in really strange ways. And it takes a while. And I'm not saying anything about the guy doing the work. I mean, that would take anyone a while. But the point is that's kind of an arduous experience. And I'm not the only one. Everyone's experiencing this who's sitting at this table. So they get it all laid out. They take a picture. And then he says, okay, that's what you're – well, first he asked me about my sunglasses. What sunglasses are you going to wear? And I'm like, well, actually, I haven't decided that yet. And he's like, well – what might they be? And I show him the sunglasses. It might be these pair, might be another pair. And he's like, okay. And so he talks about like what logos are on the sunglasses and they're, you know, how obnoxious it is or how small it is. That was the concern. Well, anyway, we get through all of that. And then I got to go to the room where, so you have the option at a race like this to bring your own bottles for your aid stations and fill them with your own something at the aid station. And you better believe they test it, by the way. So you bring your bottles there filled with your mixes and stuff, and then you give them to them the day before, and they're going to refrigerate them overnight and then have them sitting out for you at the tables. But you have to get their labels for them so that they know which bottle to put on which table, and you have six of them, and so they have to make sure they're in the right order at the right times. And so we got to handle all of that. But then you also have to remember that there are a lot of bottles sitting on these tables, anywhere between 4 and 12, depending on which table you have. And so you have to make sure that your bottle is identifiable. Well, that means things like, you know, taping it with colorful tapes or stickers or something, like decorating it. So there's a room where you go to do all of that. You handle that kind of stuff. And then from there, at that point, I just left. That was enough for me that day. I think there were other things I was supposed to do, but I was like, I'm just going to come back and do it tomorrow. So
he missed a really cool dinner, I hear.
I don't really think that I missed anything with that, but they did have other stuff. So they're really trying to, like, you know, have an experience for the athletes, which is great if you're there by yourself. But we were there with our whole family and like other people and stuff, and I wanted to spend time with them a lot more than like these athletes I've never met before and likely won't ever see again. So in my mind, it was an easy, like, I'm gonna do the pizza party with my family instead of go to the Universal Studios gala event thing with a bunch of strangers. But
they weren't all strangers.
A couple of them are people that I know.
You're friends with some.
Likely I wouldn't have seen them, though. There's so many people there. So it was cool. We definitely, you know, going through all the details and stuff, my mindset is always just like, make sure I know what I need to know and then get in and get out. And I chatted with some people, you know, ran into some people that I know from other things here and there or some athletes in the race. And we chat a little bit, but it's not really a social experience. Everyone's got their heads down. They're just taking care of business. And pre-race at these events is a very subdued time. Athletes are not super vibrant and they're not terribly interactive, certainly somewhat to some degree, but it's a night and day difference before the race and it is after the race at these kinds of things.
Did they check your shoes? Because when I ran the trials in Atlanta, they like had my shoes and they like measured the foam and everything. Did they do that?
No, they don't do that anymore because okay. World Athletics now has a published list of approved shoes and it is comprehensive. Every single shoe that's possibly on the market right now is listed as either approved or not for all of the things, track, cross country, roads, and then there's like a fourth one. I can't remember what it is. But so if your shoe just simply is not on that list, it's banned. Period. That's it. So they do random spot checks after the race and just kind of, you know, give me your shoe type of thing when you finish the race. And if you're not spot checked, then no one cares. Hmm. And I lost the race, so no one cared about my shoes.
Okay.
But that was only the first day of the 2 days before the race because there's a lot more that I had to do and it involved going back and checking in again. And then there's that mandatory technical meeting, which is great because it's a chance to just hear all the details in one quick summary for the event that you should already have known because they've been sending a billion emails ahead of time to make sure that you knew everything. But yeah, some details change and all of that. So you sit down in the technical meeting. And they do the men's and the women's separately because they don't have a room big enough for both of them. And so 200 men trying to cram, well, far more than 200 because people had coaches or teammates or something with them. But a lot of people crammed into one room trying to make sure that all the questions are answered. And you would never in your life, you'd never hear a more attentive audience to a slideshow presentation that is nothing interesting except for just information and details. I tell you what, it was dead silent, like wow. the entire time. And I know this because I sat in the very back corner, partly because it's the easiest way to get in and out quickly without interacting with anyone, but also because there were no seats available by the time I got there. And I did not get there late. I was not late. But I sat in the very back corner, and I could hear every single word that they said very easily. So
wow.
that's kind of the way it goes at those things. It was exciting. So there's energy. You feel the tension of anticipation. Yeah. It was cool. And that was the night before the race. And so then, you know, you get done with all that and you think, okay, and now I got to somehow sleep tonight so that we can have a good race tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And then the morning of, what was that like for you?
In general or for the event stuff?
I'd say for the event, what was it like? What did they want you to do? Because yeah. there's like busing and...
Yeah, I didn't really want to do the thing they wanted me to do because they wanted everyone to go to the host hotel and then take a shuttle from there to the start line area, the athlete area. I didn't want to do that because our hotel was closer to the athlete area than it was to the host hotel. And I don't want to have to run a mile to the host hotel. And then, so I instead I jogged from our hotel to the athlete area, and I kind of got stuck because I couldn't get in. There were barriers everywhere, but I found these police officers that were quite nice and told me how far I had to go to get to a spot where the barriers were open. And so eventually I figured it out and I got there. And so then you have to report into the athlete area by a certain time, and they have a couple different stipulations, but it's not terribly strict, which is kind of nice. So people are just kind of like hanging out, coming and going a little bit. But they have this like zone that is highly secure, like multiple different layers of gates wow. and stuff to get into there. And you can't get in there unless you have one of two credentials. So it's basically just the athletes and a couple of others. And then within that zone, they've got, you know, all the stuff you need. They've got the restrooms, the changing areas, the bag drop. They've got more refreshments. They constantly have refreshments for the athletes. It's great. There's water and Powerade everywhere you turn at these things. But, what they didn't have were chairs.
They didn't have enough chairs.
They had almost no chairs.
Oh, weird.
And here they were requiring, and I say that loosely because really it didn't matter, but they wanted athletes to be there about 2 hours before the start of the race. But there was nowhere to sit down. And I'm thinking to myself, what the heck were you thinking?
It is a lot of details. So that was a miss.
Yeah, whoever
but,
the
know.
Chair person was, they missed that one. But aside from the chairs, the rest of it was pretty seamless and fairly smooth. There were some golf carts sitting over there. I did sit down on the seat of a golf cart for a little while.
Okay.
I wasn't the only one. People recognized right away that since the golf carts were just sitting there, you could sit in them until someone tells you to get up. I also found a chair that was one of the race officials' chairs, but they weren't sitting in it at the time and they weren't anywhere close by, so I took their chair also.
Okay, well.
Anything to find a place to sit.
That's so interesting.
That's kind of it. And then at about 45 minutes, at about 20 minutes before the race, then they do this big like walk up, and it was kind of dramatic and a little bit cool. But they get all the athletes and like, all right, let's go. We're walking. And then we all just walk in a giant, cause there's 200 men, right? And so we walk in this giant cluster of people, and it's about a 300 meter walk or so from the athlete area to the actual start line. And it's like walking through the fenced off area where there's like huge crowds. And so people just start like cheering and we're just walking by. It kind of felt like that, like, you know, walking under the tunnel under the stadium thing, except we're not nearly as cool. But that was really fun. That was, you know, it's kind of just like, oh yeah, this is a big deal.
That's cool. Yeah.
That's it. And then we're at the start line. And they had a couple porta-johns at the start line, which is great. So then since we had a few minutes, the men all lined up for the porta-johns, and they start calling everyone to the start line, and the lines are still a decent size. And, well, I guess two notes of observation. One is a little bit of TMI, but it became abundantly clear to the men in the line that we weren't probably going to get through this line before we needed to get over that start line. And if you're not familiar with porta-johns, they usually have a place where you can sit down and do your business, and a place where you can stand up and do your business in one porta-john, right? There's two different spots. you know, for the men to have a spot and for everyone else who needs to sit down. So the men in the race figured that you could go two to a porta-john.
Oh, my word.
Really easily, because there's so plenty weird. Of space in there. And you're not even facing each other, so there's no problem. So I only say that because anyone in the public who is looking on noticed two men going in and two men coming out of the porta-johns on a regular basis. That's why. Because we were in a hurry, but it was kind of funny. And everyone was getting a good chuckle out of it, especially the ones who were doing so. I did not share a porta-john with anyone, but I didn't need to because I was in the very back of the line. And I let everyone go in front of me because my strategy for the race was to be in the very back of the race as well. And so I thought, I'm in no hurry to get to the start line. So I let them all go in front of me, and then I went into the porta-john. And I still had plenty of time. I got to the start line right when they were singing the national anthem. It was great.
Wow. Nothing like cutting it close.
No worries.
So I'm wondering, there's a lot of questions I want to ask you, Zach, but I think maybe we'll start with the course, what the course is like.
Yeah. It was nice.
Okay. No hills, it was flat?
Yeah, it was flat.
Or was
flat.
There any? I hear there's one hill.
I don't remember.
If you don't it remember was, it? No, because, over and over again.
Because it's not like
course.
Hilly. It's definitely not hilly. And people who like run on flat terrain all the time would notice a hill, and people who run on hilly terrain a lot wouldn't notice it at all. And so it's one of those kinds of things. I'm sure there was some kind of gradient change at some point, but it was not substantial. It was a fast course, and if it's not for the nature of that particular event, this would be the kind of course that people could run fast on for sure. But it's a lap course. They do this for the TV coverage as well as for the details, you know, just trying to manage the details of 200 athletes that you're trying to supply individual personal nutrition to and things like that. So they use a lap course structure. That means we did a 2.2 loop for just kind of setting it up, and then three times on an 8-mile loop. And it was an exact 8-mile loop. I guess the course measurer guy was quite proud of his ability to do that in that area especially. So we do the three times on the 8-mile loop. That's I don't mind it. Some people don't like lap courses, but I think it's all the same largely. So that made for great spectating though, because you're going through the same areas a few times, and people, you know, the giant crowds by the start finish area, like the most amount of spectators I've ever seen at a race before. But then you kind of go out, and the loop is essentially like an out and back with a little kind of loop on the end. So it's basically 4 miles out and 4 miles back. There were people all along that entire 4 mile stretch, like the whole way. Which is really saying something, because most of the time in a race like that, yeah, people are in like the city center by the start finish, but that's about it. Not here. It was everywhere. It was crazy. Very cool.
Yeah, I did a lot of running back and forth.
Back and forth.
Back and forth, back and forth. Got a little fart licking, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So how did the race unfold for you? This is something that people have been asking me, but I'd rather have them hear it from you than me try to like relay your experience.
Yeah, it was an unfortunate experience for me. So I have two general approaches with the way I race largely. One is I don't pay any attention to things like time and pace and that kind of stuff, and I do everything based on how I'm feeling. And the other is I have a kind of game plan for how I need to address the basic need factors, like fluids for races like this. If it's hot, there's certain things that I do, all that kind of stuff. But then a lot of contingencies in mind, like what kinds of things do you need to think about when things are going wrong type of stuff. And that's the way I race then. And as I just operate under the assumption that things are going to go smoothly until it's evident that they're not. And then, you know, what are the backup plans? So I didn't get 2.5 miles into the race before it was abundantly clear to me that there was going to be a problem. And what it amounted to was they have these personal aid stations where your own bottles are set up. The first one was at 2.5 miles. And I take that bottle and I start trying to drink from it. And I just like really just couldn't really drink from it. Like I could swallow a little bit, but it was like that feels like it's just going to come right back up. And it's not the sense of, you have to think about it like this. It's not that my gut felt like I didn't feel sick in any way. It's that I felt full, like my gut would not allow anything to come into it is the sensation you get. So I swallow it and it feels like it just stays somewhere in between my stomach and my throat. That's not good. This is not also the first time it's happened. And so I was very familiar with what that as soon as I felt that, I was like, okay, I know what's going on here. The last time it happened, I tried forcing it for a while, and it didn't go well. Basically, spent the whole race trying to prevent it all from coming back up. So I thought, okay, time for the backup plan. And I was only 2.5 miles into the race. And so at that point, it was, all right, this is a hot day as far as marathons go. It's going to get up to 70 or more by the end of the race. And I'm not used to running in weather like that, coming from Michigan in the winter. So immediate like mitigation factors need to be in place. But the other side of it is, you know, I have to also be attentive to how I'm feeling and make sure that I'm staying well within myself, because if you have to run a marathon without taking any substantial fluids, you have to do it differently than if you can run a marathon with things going kind of smoothly. So that being the case, I spent the first chunk of it, about 8 miles, kind of just running relaxed and trying to just stay comfortable. And it was very clear that I wasn't going to be able to sustain that amount of effort based on not how my legs were feeling, but on just in general, like energy levels and how much fluid I was not able to take in. I was kind of holding out hope that maybe I would start to be able to take in more fluid, and it wasn't helping. So about 8 miles in, I started cutting back the effort just a touch, reducing exertion a little bit to try to conserve more. And at that point, I'm full on trying to work through the mitigation factors. And that includes things like, okay, if you can't replenish fluids, you have to sweat as little as possible. And so, thankfully, at this race, they have lots of aid stations, tons of them. And it's like every couple of miles. And at each aid station, they have goo gel packet things, Martins. They have water bottles, they have Powerade bottles, and they have sponges soaked in ice water. I love it that they do this at these events. Sponges soaked in ice water, just stacks of them. So you can grab every single table. I grabbed like 4 of them. And then what you do with these sponges is you put them all over the place. And so you drip the ice water all over your head, down your neck, on your arms, you know, all the places where you are likely to be sweating, you try to get them iced watered. And so reducing the amount of sweating that my body needs to do was priority number one. Priority number two is, even though I can't swallow anything, you still absorb stuff in your mouth, including electrolytes, including, you know, water has some value just being in your mouth. So at the aid stations, I would take these bottles that I had mixed up, as well as just the water bottles, and I would just carry them for a while and sip on it and then spit it out and sip on it and spit it out. And so every once in a while, I'd try to swallow a little bit too, but I couldn't do that too often because it wasn't going anywhere. So that's what I did from that point on the rest of the race to try to prevent the inevitable catastrophe. And it helped, but it didn't help enough. So, you know, several miles later, I had to slow a little bit more. Several miles later, slow a little bit more. I get to the point about 20 miles in where it's like, I might not be able to get through the end of this. I could walk at this point on, and I might not be able to get through the end of this. So I have to reduce effort as much as I can while still moving forward. And the whole focus for me at that point was, I have all of these friends and family here who are cheering me on and stuff, and I got to get across the finish line because it's a great experience being a part of this thing. And, you know, you want to do whatever you can to say, like, I did what I could. But also, like, you know, it felt wrong to, you know, the people who are there to, you know, have them not be able to see me get all the way through it. So I kept going. I kept going slower and slower and slower, but it kept going. And eventually got to the point where it was like, all right, there's about 0.5 mile to go. I don't think I'm going to collapse no matter what I do for the 0.5 mile. So let's run it in and get through it. And that's what I did.
I'm glad that you shared your experience, because it is so tough. It's like such a tough sport in general. But then the marathon, like, if you're not able to get in crucial fluids when it's hot, you're going to suffer. So I did appreciate that you were able to manage your efforts so that you could finish it. It was a tough day for a lot of people out there, and about 50 people. So 25% of the athletes, at least with the men, dropped. And there's no shame in that. There's probably people that are listening that were part of that group. But Zach just chose a different path where he just started to run within the effort that he'd be able to finish.
Yeah, that's about the thing. And it was a rough day. You know, these things always are. But mad props to so many people who were doing some amazing things. And that's really what we want to talk about next.
Yeah. But first, before we do, the whole thing about the sponges was really fun for the rest of us because Zach was throwing his sponges at like his nephew, and he threw one at me, and he threw one at our athlete Steph, but he missed and hit someone else. So nice. It ended up being kind of a fun.
I also hit one of the other runners.
Oh no.
I tried to throw it like up above us, but the sponges were kind of thin. And so you throw them like a Frisbee and then they curve in the air, and it came down right on his head. Just blamp right on the top of the guy's head a little ways behind me.
He probably didn't mind it.
I don't know, but he ended up beating me in the race by like a lot. So I think it's forgivable. Like he gave me what for as a result. That's all right. Yeah, yeah. Throwing the sponges. You know, you gotta keep it interesting. And then the best part about it for me was because I was running so slow, the women who started 10 minutes behind the men caught me before they finished. And so I got to see who the women who were going to make the Olympic team were, because as they were passing me, they were far enough apart that it was evident like who the top three were. And I got to cheer them on as they were coming through. And that was fun, because otherwise I wouldn't have had a clue what was happening in the races, you know, in the front of the men's and women's races, except that they caught me. And that was great. So yeah, those are fun times.
Thank you for sharing, Zach.
Okay. Before we move on fully, there are a couple of other just fascinating things that stood out to us about some of the things athletes were doing. I want to share one, and you have a couple you might share as well, Andy. So these races, as I mentioned, are very fascinating experiences. One of the things that makes them interesting is how much some people will strategize what they do with their aid station interactions. So I mentioned to you, like for me, my mitigation strategies involved how I was using those aid stations. Well, Clayton Young, who finished second in the race, spoiler alert. We'll talk more about that. Clayton Young had the craziest aid station bottle strategy that I've heard yet. And here's what he did. He took these big, like, stainless steel thermoses, okay, and he filled them with water and then put in the thermos a hat and a bottle, like a plastic bottle that had his actual drink mix in it, put it in the thermos inside that water that was in the thermos, put the cap on it, and then froze them before turning them in to the race officials the night before the race. And his thought being they would thaw. He actually tested this a lot. He said specifically he tested this a lot, knowing exactly how much time there was between when he turned in the bottles and when he would be using them in the race and stuff. How long would it take to thaw in a refrigeration unit, because they would be refrigerated. And it's all very funny. So every time he took a bottle, there were six of them, in that bottle he had an ice-watered hat to change out so he could swap for a new hat, and a cold bottle with his actual drink mix. I just thought that was borderline insanely clever. Like, too clever that you don't need to be that clever. But that was just really funny to me. He said in an interview, he's like, I don't know if it actually really helped. He's not sure he likes running with hats anyway. And then he said, well, and it's, you know, was it necessary? Because we also had those sponges, remember, everywhere. And so who knows if it was necessary. But
I mean, he seemed to feel the best out of anybody out there.
He definitely looked
so,
at the end.
I don't know. Maybe it did.
Maybe. But he also had a little bit of like a kind of benefactor mindset, because he thought, I'll sign the hats also. And then he just threw them off when he was switching them out in the course. And so random people collected a Clayton Young signed hat at the event.
That's neat.
And of course, they're not giving them back to him. No That's one ever cool. would. And so, you know, then now you've got an Olympian's hat as well.
That's really cool. That was
fun.
That.
And of course, if he wouldn't have made the Olympic team, then they'd be basically worthless. But no, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. That was fun. Okay, cool.
Another interesting preparation technique that CJ Albertson used was he would run on his treadmill with like warming lights, chicken lights, and he would put hot water, boiling water in the room to make it humid to replicate the humidity and heat that he could encounter in Orlando. Isn't that interesting?
That sounds miserable.
So he like made his own
His own running sauna.
Running sauna. Yeah. That's pretty much what that would be, huh?
Dude, just go to Florida for a month, man.
We can't all go to Florida for
a month. Actually, it wouldn't have helped that much either. Because Florida was not that hot for the month leading up to the race. It was warmer, in fact, on race day than it had been for a while.
I loved that they had Meb on for some of the broadcast, asking him some questions and things. But I loved what he said, and I just think, you know, there's so much suffering in this race that it should be said again, maybe, because we all need to hear it, including myself. You should feel good at mile 20 if you're going to be the one to turn up the heat for the last 10K. Like, if you want to be the one to win, you have to be within yourself for the first 20 miles.
Yeah.
Yep. That's great advice.
It is.
Yeah.
Which harkens to some of the things that happened in the later stages of the race. We'll talk about
that.
A lot
of people suffered. It was a rough day. And it's funny because Let's Run said that it was a mildly warm day.
Yeah, it is.
I was out there. I was like sweating. The sun was like pretty intense.
That's because you came from being in like 30 degree weather.
The sun was intense. You were sunburnt afterwards.
Oh, yeah. Everybody was sunburnt. Yeah.
It was not like mild, I don't feel.
Nope.
Maybe for Florida it's mild, but not for running marathons.
Nope. Not mild.
Well, I think we should get on, Zach, to the world of running. First up in the world of running, A to Z runner Kate ran her fastest 10K since she was in her 20s.
Wow.
She ran a fantastic 10K, super fast. Anyway, so that was really exciting.
Congrats, Kate.
There might have been more who participated in the Groundhog Marathon and Half Marathon and 1/6 Marathon.
Yes, there were. Yep.
I tried to look at the results. I didn't see any. I did see like a couple like anonymous participants, and then there was Baby Shark.
We know that could have been one of ours. Participated. We know there are a few that we know for sure did something, but it's hard to pinpoint exactly what some of those somethings were. So anyway, we can update some more of, there's some other things we may have to share with you. And when we figure it out, we will. But congrats to anyone who's in the Midwest running events right now in wintry conditions. I don't know why people do that, but
it was actually the nicest Groundhog Day ever.
It wasn't 0 degrees, at least.
And the ground was clear.
Not icy.
So good year to do it. I think it's, yeah. I don't know. I think I'd prefer those conditions over Orlando conditions for a marathon.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Speaking of
Orlando, you've heard Zach talk enough about his stuff, which I'm sure very few of you cared to hear that much detail about Zach's experience. But what you really want to know is what actually happened in the race.
Yeah. So for the men's race, it went out with everyone there. It seemed like it did not string out early. Everyone was kind of in the mix early on.
That's because it didn't go out too fast. They were conservative enough in the first couple miles that it just kind of clumped up. And then when things started to accelerate a bit, it was more gradual. And so
it made for a crazy first water station.
Did it?
It looked wild to me. Like a couple people missed it. Someone's like climbing over. I don't know. It just looked
climbing,
not climbing, but like going between people trying to like grab their bottle. And it was not graceful. It was not pretty. I thought that was pretty. It looked crazy to me.
So here's the thing with the stations, right? They've got 33 different tables for 200 men to grab their bottles from. And you know which table your bottle is on. And so if your bottle is on like the first few tables, you get right over to the side right away because you have to get it right away. If your bottle is on one of the last tables, just hang off to the side and wait. Come on, people. Be smart here. But, you know, people get a little desperate and not always do smart things. And so you get some chaos at the aid stations.
Yeah. So the men stayed in a closer pack than the women did. The women went out a lot more aggressively than the men. It appeared it strung out more quickly. Zach Panning started leading about 5 miles, and Clayton Young and Connor Mance quickly followed, tucked in behind Zach Panning. And Panning really laid the hammer down in the 6 mile, running a 4:49 mile. And that's when there started.
Casual 449.
I'd say quite a few men reacted, though, and stayed close, stayed within striking distance. So, but it was interesting because, like, at mile 13, it seemed like all the men were, like, in a row with Panning leading and then Mance behind him and then, you know, like, a couple of the other guys. So it strung out. Like, it wasn't like they were all in this big
group anymore. It's also because mile 13 was, like, right next to one of the aid stations. So they're stringing out to make sure they can get their bottles. They probably clump up for a while, string out again. But why was it stringing out so much? Because Panning was putting the pedal to the metal. He was trying to really push it.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was trying to get a time of under 208 so that they would unlock another.
Do you know that for sure?
That's
been
what
trying
the
to
articles
that out.
Are all saying.
Yeah,
that
but
he
did
was trying
he
to go for
say
the time.
That?
I don't know. He didn't.
I've never heard him actually say that. And this is interesting to me. This is certainly. Unless someone has confirmed it, is speculation. But it's an interesting speculation because there's no true motivation to achieve that time standard at this moment because, yes, it does guarantee that the U.S. unlocks the third spot, but it is almost guaranteed. It's almost assured that the U.S. is going to unlock that spot anyway just because of the nature of the current situation and rankings and such. And so for someone to, like, stake their whole race opportunity on needing that time seems a bit outside the likelihood to me.
Okay.
But he may have been doing that deliberately. I think more it was just Zach Panning saying, I'm feeling pretty good, and the faster this goes, the fewer people are in it in the end of the race. And so
And he has told us on our podcast, he's a previous podcast guest, that he doesn't like it to come down to a kick. So
not many marathoners do.
Not many do. Yeah. So at, let's see, 3 miles to go, Young and Mance pulled away from Zach Panning. And Young and Mance stayed together, like, until the very end of the race.
Which is a familiar sight if you've been watching them race in the last 6 months. This is a dynamic duo thing they've been doing. They are
teammates, although they run for two different sponsors.
Yeah, but they train together. Mm-hmm. They both train underneath their the BYU college coach in some capacity still too, and so they've been pretty tight for some time working together.
It was really interesting, and there's so much buzz about it because it appeared and was confirmed later that Young let Mance win.
He did. There's no denying it. They even kind of fessed up, but. What? We really want to know. We want to know. And there's some of this that they wouldn't ever actually say exactly what, you know, what's going on here. But there's a ton of speculation about exactly why Young would let Mance win this particular time. We know why Mance has let Young win in other instances. And they could have gone back and forth. And
Young clearly felt better. He was like,
clearly. He was like waving Mance up, like, get up here, man. Slowing down for him. Yeah.
It was obvious. But he did say in an interview, he let me win the 20K. I let him win the Olympic Trials Marathon, Young said. It all washes out in the end. I know that people will look at our 1-2 punch in New Haven as well as here as a team success. And then Mance said that there was no spoken agreement about Orlando, but Young said something to Mance and then they couldn't hear and then they couldn't remember. So I don't know what happened or what he was saying.
This sounds so conspiratorial.
It does.
But so here's what they say. All right. If you watch the race, as they're approaching the finish line, clearly Young turns and he's saying something to Connor Mance. Now, do you believe that both of them forgot what he said in that moment? Not a chance. Not a chance. But, of course, he said something about this whole, like, you know, finishing order that needed to happen here. They clearly agreed on something ahead of time. In this situation, what do we want to do here? And that was a premeditated decision on Young's part. There's no doubt about it. And so you look at that and you think, okay, what? Why? What would be the reason? It's not because Mance let Young win the 20K. Mance let Young win the 20K because Young was contending for the road circuit title. And so Mance, who didn't really care about the road circuit title, definitely wanted Young to win that because he gets the whole series if he wins that. So That's an obvious one. And the Olympic trials is a totally different entity. However, all the speculation suggests that if there is one compelling reason, at least, why young let mans win, it is most likely the money and most likely has to do with bonuses in their contracts. Now, if that's true, neither one of them would ever admit to that to anyone except for each other, like on pain of death. So you're never going to hear that. You're never going to hear confirmation. But there are certainly some reasons that are likely in a situation like that. And it's not just because he patted my back this one time, so I'm going to pat his back here. No. That's not enough of a reason.
I have to say, them working together, I'm sure was an advantage.
Oh, yeah.
And to have the familiarity of one another's company while they're training and then in this race, they were stronger together than they would have been separated. So it is cool to see them working as a team and finding success this way. It'll be interesting to see what they choose to do at the Olympics and how far that will go, or and is it always going to be something that they stay together? But if someone's feeling good, are they, you know? So we'll see. We'll see what happens. There's a lot that will transpire. There's a lot of different, I mean, it's not going to be like they're 1-2, you know?
Well, no, I would anticipate a similar kind of approach to what they did in the Chicago Marathon this year, which was just like this. They ran together. They helped each other out. And there was a little bit of separation right in the end. It's kind of just like who's got it now, because they both were running fast enough to hit that standard time. And so then it was just, you know, let's see who can win across the line. I would see something like that for sure.
So that there wasn't a big move in the front. 209.05 for the win and 209.06 for Young. But the biggest move of the race was made by Career. He was 37 seconds out from third at 24 miles, but ended up passing Zach Panning and Elkana Kabet in the final mile. And Career ran his 26th mile in 5:08 to Kibet's 5:24. So he ended up winning by only 5 seconds. I did see that finish and I tried to record it, but I was too crazy excited and I, you know, didn't quite catch it. But it was close. It was so close. And it's pretty cool for Career to be able to get this third place finish, because you'll remember at the last Olympic trials in 2020 in Atlanta, he was the fourth man out by only 3 seconds.
First man out, fourth place. Oh, yes.
First man out, fourth place, only 3 seconds. So now he claimed his Olympic team spot after that heartbreak.
Got it back.
Now,
and it should be noted, that last mile is clearly one of the slowest miles of the course. If there's any gradient increase, any uphill, it is in that mile. And so you saw a lot of people running their slower miles in that final mile for more reasons than just because it's the last mile of a marathon. So for Career coming in like that, you know, just with a full head of steam and a 5:08, they ran plenty of miles much faster than that during the race. But at that point, he was moving past people.
Mm-hmm. Career's spot will not be officially confirmed until May 5th, but his 209.57 at the Olympic trials is worth more in ranking points, and he ended up being able to surpass Scott Faubel's position, so he is actually the higher ranked one.
He's in, yeah.
So, and the interesting thing too is that, let's scroll down here, 13 men would have to pass him for him not to make it.
Yeah.
And they'd have to be ones that aren't already going to go based on time.
Right. So it's very possible, but but that's not just 13 people in the world. And so he's ranked 68th in the world, right? But that is 68th out of the top three of each eligible nation. And so that means there are way more than 68 Kenyan, Ethiopian, and Japanese runners ahead of him on the list. But you only get three from your nation. And so when we say 13 more men have to pass him, we're talking about 13 men from nations that don't already have three in front of him, which is why it's almost no chance that's going to happen at this point. So no one's really worried about it, least of all Leonard Career. He's confident. He is confident that he's in now. Mm-hmm. But the point is, there is some small chance that he could get knocked out of the ranking, but it's not going to happen. He's definitely in.
Now, Kibet seemed elated with his performance even though he narrowly missed the team. But there are good reasons that he would be very happy. Two of them are that he is the Olympic alternate in fourth place. And the second one is that he just got the new American Masters marathon record in a time of 2:10.02. He's 40 years old this year. Wow. And ran the new record. So that's really cool.
It is really something when you think about just the old theory that, you know, you reach a certain age and then it's just no longer possible for you. We're just seeing that disproven across the board in so many ways. But for Elkana Kabet to run 2:10 and fourth place at the U.S. Olympic trials at 40 years of age, just, you know, that's really impressive stuff.
Yeah, it really is. It's exciting, too. We do want to shout out Nate Martin, who's a friend. Can I call him a friend? Would you call me a friend, Nate? He came on the A to Z Running podcast, and we've been following his career for quite some time. He was seventh place in a time of 2:11 flat and was in that group and really made a good effort to stick with that top to try to make the Olympic team. So that was a very brave race, but also he hung on for seventh, which is the most impressive thing about it.
That's the truth. And Nate Martin was not that far off his personal best time in the marathon, which is just really saying something for someone to be able to do that at that event in those conditions. This guy is just amazing. Mm-hmm. Good stuff, Nate. Love to see it.
So now we'll move on to the women at the Olympic trials that, in contrast to the men, went out more aggressively and strung out very quickly. So early on, less than 2 miles in, Kira D'Amato was leading. Fiona O'Keefe was on her shoulder. You had Emily Sisson. You had all the players there. Sarah Hall, Betsy Sena, Natasha Rogers, Emily Durgan, all of them were all just in front. And there's an 8-woman separation before mile 3, but then they were joined by others as early as 4 miles. So they were moving up and down like a yo-yo string.
Huh.
Dakota joined the lead pack at 4 miles. And then
Dakota
a few
Lindworm.
Others. Lindworm. What did I say?
You just didn't say her last name.
Oh, okay.
We haven't announced her yet this. So.
Dakota Lindworm joined the pack at 4 miles, and a few others joined at that time as well. But the true separation happened between 8 and 9 miles. Mm. And there's about 13 women in the group, which included more names that you've heard on this podcast, Nell Rojas and Lindsay Flanagan. And then at mile 10, O'Keefe and Lindworm push ahead of D'Amato and Hall. And it was really fun to see Dakota Lindworm's big smile. She's known for that. It's her signature thing. But she's like out there in front being bold, which was really cool. And then the race played out. There's so much that I didn't see and wasn't televised of like, they only really showed the front runners. So I really would love to know more from these athletes of how everything exactly played out. But at mile 19, O'Keefe broke away with a 5:22 mile, which I guess there's a small uphill. Do you remember it, Zach?
Nope.
At mile 19. And that's when she started to just dial it in. And she did not let off. And her lead only grew over the last 8 miles of the race. In fact, she ended up running a 5:09 for her 25th mile.
That's crazy.
Very impressive.
That is the faster mile of that straightaway. So I mentioned the 26th mile is the slower one. The faster one is the 25th. So everyone kind of saw a little bit faster time during that stretch usually. But 5:09, she was moving.
Yeah. And
that's also about when she passed me, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yep. And she was really moving faster than me, so.
And there was a lot of like big names that dropped out or ended up having really rough last bits. Like D'Amato as one of the favorites, she dropped out at 20. It was a tough day. Mm. And the marathon is just a beast. It's brutal. Sisson was second place, and she ran a negative split race of 71:43 for her first half, 71:01 for her second. But O'Keefe, in her debut marathon negative split, her race in 71:43, which was the same. And then her second half was 70:27.
So if you didn't catch what Andy just said, Fiona O'Keefe just won the U.S. Olympic trials in her first ever marathon.
First ever.
She qualified with a half marathon time. Had never run a full. So that's what she does. Not only that, how fast did she actually run it, Andy?
She ran a time of, can you help me with this?
Yeah, well, she ran 2:22 and change. You got the exact 2:22:10.
And this, so there has been a lot of clamor about this because it's an Olympic trials record. And she ran this in her debut. She's the first woman to win the Olympic trials marathon in her debut, right?
I don't know.
I believe so. But no one's talking about this. And I looked it up. I'm pretty certain of it. I think it is a marathon debut American record. Fastest debut by any American woman ever. Because Jordan Hsieh ran 2:23 when she set the record. Hmm. And Fiona O'Keefe just ran 2:22:10.
Yeah.
So I think that's obviously faster. So unless someone has run faster in the meantime, I suppose that could be. But there's no official place where they keep these records.
So you've got an unexpected victor in Fiona O'Keefe, who was not on anyone's radar to be one of the top spots in this race. Emily Sisson finishing second was a definite expectation. She was a shoe-in in most betting people's
minds.
Well,
I mean, she's the American record holder.
American record holder, and certainly has some decent consistency at the event lately. So that's good. But then in third place, another surprise.
I was thrilled, and I was screaming my head off for Dakota Lindworm in third place running to make her first Olympic team. Incredibly exciting. Now, she's been good a long time, but for her to level up in this way was absolutely thrilling.
Well, and it also, you have to remember, how did she achieve this in this moment? Well, she did two things very well here. First, she stayed tough when it was a very tough day. And second, she put herself in position to take advantage of, you could say, of the carnage. Because a lot of big players did not finish this race. And a lot of other big players finished way further back than their projections because the day wasn't theirs, because the conditions got to them, you know, all the reasons, right? But in Dakota Lindworm's situation, she simply was in position to be able to take advantage of the fact that there wasn't anyone else in front of her anymore. And you credit to her for doing what it
Huge.
Took to
yeah.
get there.
And she moved into that spot during mile 22. And she wasn't, I mean, obviously at mile 22, you're not feeling awesome. So she was able, like you said, Zach, to hang tough. And she did have to continue to run as well as she could because fourth place wasn't terribly far behind her. And this was another big surprise because this is a name that there was no projections that said that this woman would be where she was at in this race or would be a contender for an Olympic team. Yet she was fourth. Her name is Jessica McLean. And she was part of the chase pack, so she wasn't even in a lot of the footage. Like, you didn't see her on TV because she was not in the lead pack. She was in a chase pack. And she ended up running a 4-minute PR.
What?
To run a time of 2:25:56.
On that day? At
yes.
that event?
And oh, she became the Olympic alternate. So she's actually going to go to Paris. And she was not a woman who was on anybody's lists. So incredibly, wow. incredibly impressive and inspiring. So she's unsponsored and she probably won't be for long. She probably won't be for long.
We can hope. Sponsors are fickle with these kinds of things. But that's Jess McLean there for a big moment. And then one of the big race favorites, Sarah Hall, still hanging tough and ending up fifth.
Yeah, which was very impressive. To, like Zach said, hanging on for dear life. Because except for Fiona and Emily Sisson, no one else a negative split. Everyone else kind of suffered in the end there.
Yeah. Well, and you see it in the times. We didn't mention it directly there. But so Fiona O'Keefe won the race in 2:22:10, a championship record, a trials record. Emily Sisson, about 30 seconds behind, 2:22:42. Dakota Lindworm in third place was almost 3 minutes after Sisson. So you get the point right away. No one was accelerating in the late stages of that race except for O'Keefe and Sisson, which says a lot about the two of them, but even more about just how tough the day was.
Yeah. McKenna Myler, interesting note about her is that she gave birth less than a year ago and is coming back to run 2:26.14 at the Olympic Trials, which is
finished
super
seventh.
Impressive in seventh place. Eighth place, previous podcast guest, Lindsay Flanagan. Always in the mix. She's always in the mix. One of these days, she's going to snag her podium. So exciting, though, that she's always so strong in the marathon distance. I did want to mention Dakota Lindworm. I was able to see her at the airport after the race, and she... this is me fangirling a bit about her, but I knew before this all happened, she was always like such a kind and caring person. Like we've had her on the podcast before, and
now she's not anymore. Now that she's famous.
No, she is. What I'm saying is she's just a very kind human, as a lot of these runners are. And it's so cool to see people who are humble and grateful achieve these big things. So I just wanted to say I'm a big fan of Dakota Lindworm, and I'm excited that she's going to be representing Team USA.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you've got your teams set, given other factors come together, as we anticipate they will. You should then be seeing O'Keefe, Sisson, and Lindworm for the women in the trials in the Olympics in Paris, and Mance and Young and Career, if all things go smoothly as well. So there you have it, your marathon Olympic team is set for the United States. Now, one last thing that we got to talk about, because there's a lot of other things happening aside from the U.S. Olympic marathon trials. And that includes a lot of indoor track racing, because what it comes down to is this snuck up on you. But 2 weeks from around the time when we're sharing this podcast, depends on exactly when you listen to this, but 2 weeks or fewer will be the U.S. indoor track and field championships, because the very beginning of March, first weekend of March, is the World Indoor Track and Field Championships. That is coming up quickly, which means people are needing to run some indoor races. So you get a lot of people showing up right now, big names running big races, and it's kind of fun. The New Balance Indoor Grand Prix is one of those big races at their new facilities called The Track.
Oh, yeah. The Track.
Very creative of your New Balance. Track. What should we call this track? Let's call it The Track. All right. So in this event, you've got a lot of fast things happening for distance runners, including the men's 1500-meter run. Very strong showing for United States youngster Hobbs Kessler. He's 20 years old now. It seems like this guy has just not aged yet. How old was he when he went pro? He was like 18 years old. So Hobbs Kessler turned pro right out of high school, and for good reason. But, he's just continued to improve his ability to race at the highest levels. And so here he is at the New Balance Indoor Grand Prix racing once world champion in the 1500 meters, Jake Whiteman from Great Britain. And not just racing Whiteman, but beating him in a blazing fast 3:30.3, number three all time in the United States.
Wow.
For the indoor 1500
meters. That's fantastic.
Meters. That's right. It is, in fact. And Whiteman had a strong finish, but Kessler put the pedal down earlier and than usual in a, than a kick finish. And so he had a little bit of a gap on Whiteman, and Whiteman couldn't close it. So there you go. Now, a quick note, you're going to see Kessler again next weekend racing Yared Nuguse, among others.
Ooh.
At the, I think it's Millrose. What's the next? I think it's Millrose. So we'll be reporting on that too. But Kessler had a little bit to say. He's like, yeah, I think it'd be great if Nuguse wants to run super fast. I'm game to run with him. So that's cool. All right. Women's 3,000 meters was also exciting. You got a return, Andy, a return of one
yes.
of your faves. Allie St. Pierre coming back from having a baby in March of 2023, and one of her first races back here.
Well, for indoor, because she ran that Fifth Avenue mile. She ran really fast for her first baby.
That was Rhodes. So she's back on the track again with a bang very narrowly missing the American record in the 3,000 meters.
So exciting.
2/10 of a second off of Alicia Monson's record. She runs 8:25.25. To finish second, in fact.
Wow.
That's a fast time for second place. But Jess Hull from Australia did even better and ran a new area and national record for 8:24.93.
Wow.
Moving. Now, just how fast were the two of them running? Well, they were about 7 seconds ahead of the rest of the race.
That's
how fast they were running.
Unreal for that distance.
In a world-class field. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
That's nuts.
So that's why I say 7 seconds behind them was a trio of young Ethiopians who did something that we just have to talk about. So this was Melknat Wudu, Medina Aissa, and Senayet Getachew. And so these three Ethiopians are all under 20 years of age, and all three of them ran faster than the previous World U20 record.
Snap.
Which stood prior to that day for 20 years.
Wow.
In 20 years, no one bested it. And on one day, three women did it at the same time. there's so many things. I just have to say that's crazy. But Wudu was the best of the rest there and took the new record in an 8:32.34, finishing third in the race and a new U20 world record. Wow. Then in the women's 1500 meters, world record holder Gudaf Sige apparently asked for a very fast pacing time. She holds this event's world record. That's why I say world record holder. She also holds some others, but namely the outdoor 5,000 meter. But Gudaf Sige wanted a fast time. It didn't really happen for her this time. She wasn't quite there, but further still, also wasn't alone running fast. And so it became I need to try to win this race now against another youngster from Ethiopia, 18-year-old Berke Haylum. And together, they both ran 3:58. Sige barely outstretching Haylum. But that didn't matter too much for Haylum, who ended up with a 3-second improvement on the world U20 1500 meter record. What is happening?
That's wild.
What's in the water over there?
358.43.
New record for Haylum. And then we should note Addie Wiley was in the race. I think it was her first race as a professional now.
Okay.
I'm not 100% sure about that because, you know, we have been occupied with some other things lately, but as we've been paying attention to the stuff happening in the places, I haven't seen her name in other results. But Addie Wiley finished fourth in a 4:07, her first race as a pro for Adidas. And last quick note, boys mile, JoJo Jordan, the high schooler who won Nike Cross Country Nationals this past year, became the sixth ever U.S. high school boy to run under 4 minutes in a mile indoors. He ran a 3:59.87. Barely got it, but he did.
So many fast youngsters.
Fast kids. And he won the race while he was at it, but that's because it was a high school race. Okay, so that, just quick side notes and other places in the world. That was the Nike Indoor, or sorry, New Balance Indoor Grand Prix. They would be very upset if I called it the Nike. But yeah. Other places, there were other things happening in the last couple weeks too, so we just at least need to mention Honami Maeda from Japan set a new national record in the marathon at the Osaka Women's Marathon when she ran 2:18.59. That's moving. Also guaranteeing her a spot on the Olympic team for Japan unless someone beats her national record.
Okay. Which that would be wild.
Would be something. And then for Wayne Hailu from Ethiopia also ran the number 6 all-time indoor mile in Ostrava by running 4:17.36. So there's people doing stuff. We're going to see these names again soon.
Yeah, I love that track is really, it's getting going now. We have indoor USA championships coming up shortly as well. And then, of course, we have the outdoor season and the Olympic trials. So lots of fun running results coming your way in this really exciting Olympic year. And we look forward to covering it all for you.
That is the truth.
Thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.